Today, bring in the cavalry. The DFA Daily for the 28th of April 2020. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, world's latest post covering finance and problem news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Hot on the heels of NAB yesterday, Westpac has announced impairment charges, which will be a massive $2.23 billion pre-tax in their upcoming results due the 4th of May. This includes around $0.6 billion from individually assessed provisions and net write-offs and $1.6 billion of additional impairment charges predominantly related to COVID-19 impacts. Thanks to the AASB 9 accounting standard, which requires Westpac to estimate certain expected future impairments and increase provisions before new defaults occur. The $1.6 billion addition to the impairment charge has a relatively small impact on the group's Common Equity Tier 1 capital ratio, about 11 points decrease. This is because the higher charge lifts provision levels and reduces the regulatory expected loss capital deduction to nil. And Westpac's CET1 capital ratio at the 31st of March 2020 is expected to be 10.8%, and that may suggest they won't need to raise more capital. Westpac CEO Peter King said, having materially strengthened capital over the last decade, building significant buffers, we are now well positioned to absorb this increase and respond to future developments in the environment. The first half 20 impairment charges of $2.3 billion equates to approximately 62 basis points of gross loans on an annualized basis. This compares to 13 and 9 basis points for the second half of 2019 and the first half of 2019, respectively. The $1.6 billion in additional impairment charges have been principally based on three elements. Firstly, significant changes to base case economic forecasts linked to the pandemic. These include lower economic growth, higher unemployment, lower investment, and a fall in residential and commercial property prices. Secondly, increasing the weighting applied to the downside economic scenario, reflecting a higher probability that the economic conditions will deteriorate even further. And third, an overlay based on a top-down industry-by-industry assessment of additional stress that could emerge in relation to COVID-19. And Westpac notes that the outbreak is still in its early stages and the impact on customers, along with future impacts on the bank, remain highly uncertain. While impairment provisions have begun to increase, the extent of additional charges in subsequent periods will depend on the severity and duration of the decline in economic activity and the size and effectiveness of stimulus measures, and the group will assess its provisioning levels as developments unfold. And Morningstar analysts have forecast that Australia's major banks could each be in need of multi-billion dollar injections of capital in the years following the crisis, as NAB launched its $3.5 billion raise. Despite predicting short-term earnings will fall by around 20% for the Big Four, Morningstar has remained optimistic, expecting that the banks will bounce back in the long term. However, the analyst report has tipped all banks will materially reduce their dividends with payout ratios to average 50% to 65% over the next 3 years, and it's moved its uncertainty ratings for the institutions from medium to high. Morningstar has predicted that NAB, alongside ANZ and Westpac, will each need to raise around $3.5 billion to $4 billion of equity in the next 2 years. In its base case, NAB and Westpac are expected to fall below the 10.5% CET1 ratio temporarily to around 10.1%. Elevated loan loss provisions, large provisions for penalties, remediation costs and other one-off items are expected to hit hard, they say, at the same time. And Morningstar has forecast $750 million will be needed for potential AUSTRAC and ASIC penalties for NAB, with the bank embroiled in ongoing proceedings. CBA, however, has gotten off lightly in comparison, with the report speculating a lower dividend payout ratio should be enough to see the bank meet its 10.5% requirement. In its bear case scenario, the amount needed for ANZ, Westpac and NAB rises to about $5.5 billion each as loan impairment expenses approach its peak, as much as 1% of loans in fiscal year 2021. For the last 3 years, impairment charges have been low at 0.1% of loans. And CBA, again, is the exception in the bear case, with a forecast raise of just $1 billion. But despite uncertainty being elevated, Morningstar has said Australian bank shares at 40% down since February are undervalued. And the construction sector is also under the gun. But never fear, the government will help here too. Well, perhaps, as the New South Wales Berejiklian government is considering a $50 million property spending spree, snapping up unsold apartments and fast-tracking construction as part of its coronavirus economic recovery plan. A cabinet briefing paper prepared by the government's Land and Housing Corporation says a housing-focused stimulus package would accelerate development and boost employment in New South Wales. The paper, which is marked Cabinet in Confidence and obtained by the Sydney Morning Herald, says supporting the construction industry will be a key element of economic recovery after the crisis. It recommends a three-stage approach, which will include $160 million for shovel-ready projects that could see the construction of 300 social dwellings start within 16 weeks. Another 360 dwellings could be underway in the next 30 weeks, with $190 million in funding, and the third $200 million stage would be for housing for people displaced as a result of COVID-19. The paper identifies 8 developments that already have approval in local government areas, including Canterbury, Bankstown, Liverpool and Newcastle, as well as projects that include opportunities to purchase dwellings off the plan. And it lists several projects in Parramatta, Westmead and South Granville where the government could, quote, negotiate with the developer to buy dozens of unsold apartments. This would afford the Land and Housing Corporation the opportunity to either sell on at a later date or keep as part of the Land and Housing Corporation's social housing stock, it said. And a spokeswoman for Housing Minister Melinda Pavey said the document was prepared to provide feedback to Federal Housing Minister Michael Sukkar for possible federal housing stimulus funding. It was not intended for New South Wales Cabinet, the spokesman said. But anyone else want a handout? It seems that they're all queuing up. Of course, the virus is still a total unknown, but there was some insight into the tricky path ahead to get to a vaccine. There was an interesting article from The Hill saying drug companies are racing to develop a coronavirus vaccine at breakneck speed, but they're quickly encountering challenges with clinical trials, production capacity, and government approval. The world is pinning its hopes on a vaccine to prevent COVID-19, the disease caused by the virus. Public health experts say that until a vaccine is successfully deployed, it will be difficult to completely lift the social distancing restrictions that have devastated the global economy. Normally, vaccines often take 5 to 10 years to develop. Limited human trials of some vaccine candidates are already underway, and experts say there is reason for optimism, but they're also cautious that the 12 to 18 month timeline highlighted by federal health officials in the US might need to be extended. And they note that the mumps vaccine, considered one of the fastest ever approved, took 4 years to get from initial stage development to licensing back in 1967. Probably the biggest hurdle to the vaccine is the rigorous clinical trial stage. More than 70 drug companies are working on a potential vaccine, and the majority are unlikely to make it through that process. Some firms have already launched human trials with new technology that's allowed them to use RNA or DNA sequencing to develop vaccine contenders faster than ever before. However, that technology is unproven. No RNA or DNA vaccine has ever been approved for a virus, and there aren't any drug manufacturers working to produce those types of vaccines. Modera, which launched the first clinical trial of a potential vaccine in mid-March, told Bloomberg Businessweek that it has the ability to produce millions of doses of bulk vaccine per month, but hundreds of millions of doses at a minimum will be required to prevent the disease across the entire country, said Jess Goodman, a professor at Georgetown University School of Medicine. The challenge is that some of these new technologies had never been translated into approved vaccines, and they haven't been produced at industrial scale, said Goodman, who spent more than 15 years at the Food and Drug Administration and chief scientist under former President Obama. Even if a vaccine could be developed quickly, it will require extensive testing to ensure it is safe for widespread human use. The time when companies are looking to ramp up manufacturing and have capacity is not insignificant, Goodman said. And Peter Hutz, Dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Bayer College of Medicine in Houston, said even under the most optimistic timeline, the steps for evaluating safety and effectiveness can't be rushed. You're going to need time to show, one, that the vaccine actually works, and secondly, that it's safe, and it's hard to accelerate that, Holt said. Companies are looking to speed the development of the vaccine through condensing trials, conducting multiple trials simultaneously, or even intentionally infecting people with the virus. Holtz, who is part of the team working on a potential vaccine candidate, predicted a bottleneck in the clinical trial process. The problem is not making the vaccine. The problem is you need the time to show the vaccine works and is safe, and then make sure there's a process in place to manufacture in large quantities, Holtz said. If a vaccine nears the finish line, there will be enormous pressure on the federal government to quickly approve it, Goodman said. He hopes companies can produce a vaccine that is at least 80% effective. In contrast, the annual flu vaccine ranges from 40% to 60% in effectiveness. But if we didn't, and if the disease was still actively circulating, a vaccine with lower efficacy could get approved, he added, hitting the 80% mark in a year for an injectable drug with no side effects is a fantasy, according to one drug industry consultant. It would be completely different than the entire history of pharmaceuticals since the development of penicillin, that you have a product exceptionally high in efficacy and very low on side effects. That's not the way drugs get made, said Jeff Myers, a senior vice president at Catalyst Healthcare Consulting. I think the first drug out of the chute is not going to be a magic bullet. It's going to be a start, Myers said, but you're more likely to get products that can treat symptoms way faster than you're going to get a vaccine. And Westpac New Zealand wrote an interesting piece today saying economic forecasting during COVID-19 is like being in a ring with a pro boxer. You have to move quickly and often. They now expect a deeper decline in New Zealand in the June quarter GDP of 16% because the alert level 3 restrictions are tighter than they'd previously allowed for. New Zealand may drop to level 2 earlier than we previously thought, they say, allowing for a more vigorous rebound in GDP. So they're now forecasting that GDP will rise 13% in the September quarter, previously 10%, and they've actually slightly upgraded their assessment of the level of economic activity as at September. However, beyond the initial bounce, they now expect the recovery phase will be slower as it will take longer to overcome the damage done by unemployment and business failures. Nonetheless, they still think the recovery will be more rapid than in past recessions, and they're now allowing for more permanent damage to the economy as the legacy of the virus will sap productivity growth in the 2020s due to factors including reduced investment, lost skill due to unemployment, domestication of supply chains, and increased barriers to trade and travel, as well as higher taxation required to repay government debt incurred during the crisis. They expect government debt will rise to 50% of GDP by 2024, unemployment will peak at 9.5%, and they anticipate only a slow return to below 5%, and they expect house prices will fall 7% this year and remain subdued through 2021 in New Zealand. However, they expect house prices will rise very rapidly over 2022 and 2023 in response to ultra-low interest rates. And they said one key conclusion they draw from the above is that inflation will drop to below 1% unless the Reserve Bank and government act very vigorously to stimulate the economy. The government has ponied up with massive fiscal stimulus, and they expect roughly another $15 billion of stimulus measures at May's budget. But there is a limit to what the government can provide before the debt projections become unacceptably high, especially with the ageing population looming over our fiscal future, they said. Monetary policy not only needs to come to the party, it needs to spike the punch. So far, the Reserve Bank has reduced the official cash rate by 75 basis points to 0.25%, committed to keeping it at that level until March. And it's committed to buying $33 billion worth of government and local government bonds. And this is known as quantitative easing, and it has the effect of reducing long-term interest rates. The Reserve Bank's key decisions were made on March the 16th, before the country went into lockdown. And they said, in our assessment, the Reserve Bank is going to have to step up and deliver much more monetary stimulus. At the May's MPS, they expect the Reserve Bank will almost double its QE program to $60 billion, and they estimate that total government debt will be over $130 billion by June next year. So the Reserve Bank will be on track to own about 45% of the New Zealand government bonds on issue. And they said, in our assessment, even more monetary stimulus will be required. In theory, the Reserve Bank could just continue with an even bigger QE program, but based on RBNZ commentary, they think the bank would prefer to switch to a negative official cash rate at that point. And the RBNZ has said that it would be uncomfortable owning much more than 40% to 50% of the total bond market, because this would affect market liquidity and functioning. By contrast, the RBNZ has previously said that it favours the option of a negative OCR. And so they forecast that the RBNZ will lower the OCR by 75 basis points to minus 0.5% in November this year. They said there are two impediments to the RBNZ reducing the OCR earlier. The first is that trading bank systems are not currently ready to deal with a negative OCR. Changes to documentation and computer systems are required. Holding off on a negative OCR until November should get around that. But the timing of the RBNZ's move will depend on how long it takes trading banks to prepare, which is uncertain. The second impediment is that lowering the OCR this year would break the RBNZ's commitment to keep the OCR at 0.25% until March 2021. Any move to break an earlier commitment would have to be carefully explained and justified. Forward guidance and the long lead time would help with both of the above problems. This would have the effect of reducing wholesale term interest rates immediately, effectively amounting to a monetary stimulus. And they expect that the RBNZ will signal either its intent or its willingness to move to a negative OCR at the August MPS. And they've previously written about the impact of a negative OCR. First, the lower the OCR goes, the less marginal impact it will have on retail rates, such as mortgage rates. Thus, a 75 basis point cut from 0.25% to minus 0.5% would bring mortgage rates down, but not by anything as much as 75 basis points. They estimate that in New Zealand, the OCR could go further to minus 1% before further cuts had zero impact on retail rates. This effective lower bound is lower in New Zealand than many other countries, because in New Zealand, bank deposit rates are higher relative to the OCR. And to clarify, they say, we do not expect any of the interest rates paid or received by New Zealand households and businesses to go negative. In overseas jurisdictions with negative interest rates, retail rates have almost always remained positive. However, we do expect the 90-day bill rate to go slightly below zero. This is an interbank rate, but some business interest rates are expressed as a margin over the 90-day bank bill. Our forecast for the two-year swap rate is that it will reach a low point of zero before rising again from September 2021. And finally, I found this concise article from oftwominds.com entitled "The Crash Has Only Just Begun," and it puts a lot of things into context. Everything, they say, including a rational, connected to reality, effective financial system, is on back order and unlikely to ship anytime soon. While the stock market euphorically front-runs the Fed and a V-shaped recovery, the reality is the crash has only just begun. To understand why, look at income and debt. Income earned and unearned is in freefall, while debt, which must be serviced by income, is exploding higher. Bailouts are not a permanent substitute for income. In the short term, bailouts, in the form of payments to everyone who's lost their source of earned income, i.e. their job, is a necessary substitute for lost income. But longer term, subsidizing income with borrowed money weakens the currency and the economy as productivity stagnates. As for servicing debt, the unemployed working class is getting an extra $600 a week in the US, not out of kindness, but to make sure these households can continue to service their debts, auto and truck loans, student loans, credit cards, etc. Absent a federal bailout, millions of unemployed would cease making loan payments, creating a financial crisis for lenders. Investment income is also crashing as companies slash dividends and stock market gains dry up. Oil exporters are facing a $1.2 trillion cut in annual income, and institutional property owners are facing steep declines as tenants stop paying rents, and structural declines in employment will pressure rents lower in housing and commercial properties. As the housing market implodes, capital gains from flipping houses will also collapse. As corporate America realizes it no longer needs vast office spaces for its reduced workforce, as millions are working from home, the demand for commercial properties will fall off a cliff, and the rental income generated by commercial property will also fall off a cliff. Even if interest rates fall to zero, the interest paid by borrowers will not be zero. But even if borrowers get very low rates, they still have to make the monthly principal payments, which can run into hundreds of dollars. Lowering interest rates doesn't reduce the principal payment or reduce the interest due to zero. Indeed, the student loan and credit card rackets are experts at sucking borrowers dry with late fees and much higher rates than initially advertised. Capital isn't flowing into productive investments. It's front-running the Federal Reserve's free money for financiers in grossly overvalued stocks and seeking dead money safe havens. The money that's being sent to unemployed workers is borrowed, and small businesses are being offered loans, much of which will be forgiven if the funds are used to pay wages. In other words, all of these trillions of dollars being substituted for earned income are borrowed. And with capital going to grossly overvalued big tech stocks and dead money safe havens, there are no capital flows which will support a return to commerce and productivity, then will pay wages or generate investment income, in other words, unearned income. Now, bulls can argue that this time is different, that debt doesn't matter, earnings don't matter. But where is the history to support their claim that capital flowing into overvalued stocks is going to generate earned income that can service the exploding debt load? The crash has only just begun, and everything, including a rational, connected to reality, effective financial system is on back order and unlikely to ship anytime soon. And I have to say, I think they have nailed it. And so, whilst they can call in the cavalry, which will be lower interest rates, negative interest rates, it doesn't fundamentally solve the debt problem that has been built. And in fact, the amount of debt that's accumulating because of all these various programs around the world is taking debt to ever higher levels. Now, some people will say debt doesn't matter. We don't have to repay it. We can just roll it over. But I'm afraid that I still come back to a pretty fundamental point that at some point, debts do need to be repaid. And whatever the interest rates may be, it is the capital repayments which will really bite. And thus, I think this is a one-way street to oblivion. And so far, I have to tell you, I can't see a way back. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.